18 years ago, U.S. Senator Dick Durbin introduced the DREAM Act. Last week, the democratically controlled House passed the latest version of that bill. Will it be introduced in the Senate? That and more with Senator Durbin today. And Americans older than 65 will become our largest age group within the next 20 years. Advocates say that means it's time to rethink the way we design our local communities. Plus, have you heard of the idea of over-tourism? That's when too many people are visiting the same spots. What can you do about it?
The 21st is a production of Illinois Public Media, airing on WILL in Urbana, WUIS in Springfield, WGLT in Normal, WNIJ in DeKalb, and WCBU in Peoria.
That's all coming up this hour on the 21st. Stay tuned. Welcome to the 21st. I'm Nyla Boodoo. Coming up later this hour, how our cities and towns across Illinois can be designed with older adults in mind, plus the impact of over-tourism on some of our most popular destinations. Sometimes too many visitors can hurt both the environment and local communities. But first, we're about halfway through the first year of this Congress with a Democratic House and a Republican Senate. Very few major bills, if any, are making it through both chambers. There's also no shortage of national headlines, whether it's the House holding Attorney General William Barr in contempt or the latest in the 2020 Democratic primary. Here in Illinois, we're facing some major challenges, including flooding that's affecting our farmers and towns near the Illinois and Mississippi rivers. Yesterday on the Senate floor, U.S. Senator Dick Durbin showed his colleagues a picture of a grain elevator in Alton.
Today, it's our floods in the Midwest. Tomorrow, it's that tornado in Oklahoma. And the list goes on and on and on. I stand ready to work with everyone I can locally to deal with this. But I also plead with this administration, open your eyes to the reality of climate change in the world and what it's doing to the extreme weather patterns which we currently face.
That's Senator Durbin yesterday. I had a chance to catch up with him earlier this morning to talk about that and more. Senator Durbin, welcome back to the 21st.
Good to be with you.
So, Senator, I wanted to ask you, you were the author of the original DREAM Act that would have protect young people who were brought here illegally by their parents. And I know you and Lindsey Graham reintroduced this in the Senate back in March. I'm asking you about this because last week the House passed a version of this with some Republican support. Do you think this will be introduced in the Senate?
I doubt it. Unfortunately, Senator McConnell is not allowing any of the bills that are passing over the House to come forward. In the Senate, it's really a waste of space here. We're just lurching from one stack of McConnell nominations to another, not taking up important legislation. The DREAM Act, which passed with a bipartisan roll call in the House of Representatives, the reauthorization of the Violence Against Women's Act, a reform bill on ethics in Congress, which is long overdue, all of these passed the House, and Senator McConnell won't allow them to be considered in the Senate.
Given that, what recourse do Democrats in the Senate have here?
An election, and that's what it comes down to. The American people have to decide if they like this president and the way he's handling the issues facing our nation, and whether they want to give to Senator McConnell another 2 years of control over our federal courts, where he is pushing through appointees, not totally, but in some cases, who are unqualified for the job for lifetime appointments. That's what elections are all about.
I wanted to ask you about something you were tweeting about yesterday, Senator. This is also related to immigration. It's the fact that six children have died in U.S. custody since being apprehended at the border. And when we think about the conditions inside detention facilities, we don't know very much about them. And I'm thinking in particular of one facility in Florida in Homestead, where there are more than 2,000 children. And what we know is just court filings saying that the conditions there are not good, maybe in some cases very bad. These are children who in some cases were forcibly separated from their families. And I wanted to ask you what responsibility you think Congress has to be looking into these facilities and know what's going on there and looking after these children.
This is a tragic chapter in American history. We will be answering for this to future generations, and I'm not exaggerating. The Inspector General just finished a survey of the detention facilities for those at our border and found it dangerous and unacceptable and inhumane. On April the 12th, I was at the El Paso crossing, went in and saw the detention cells. There's a cell with a large plate glass window on the outside. The sign over the door said capacity 35. There were 150 men standing there shoulder to shoulder. I received a call from a whistleblower not long afterwards, said they're up to 200 in that same cell. They eat standing up. There's one toilet. It is an outrageous situation. We gave the Trump administration $400 million in February to start doing humane things, particularly when it comes to the treatment of children, and they've been dragging their feet.
Just to ask you all about another foreign relations kind of issue in a way. Yesterday on the program, we were actually talking about the U.S.-China relationship and how it affects higher education. And when you think about how many students here in Illinois are from China, we talked about we had representatives from the U of I and ISU on, and they were talking about how the FBI has been visiting universities, including the University of Illinois, telling them to be careful about doing research with Chinese institutions and scholars for fear that sensitive research could end up with the Chinese government. And I wonder how you think we can protect sensitive information while also making sure the Chinese students who are studying here don't feel like they're being unfairly singled out.
Well, that's an extraordinarily important question, and timely as can be. We've reached a point where just a few years ago, 80% of Chinese students studying in the United States for advanced degrees, for example, stayed in the United States. Now the opposite is true. 80% return to China. It doesn't make sense for us to send them back with an American education to compete with us, whether it's for national security or in the marketplace of goods and ideas. But we've got to be careful. The Chinese have a plan, and that plan involves trying to capture some of our best technology and best ideas. I'm using the word capture when I could also say steal. So we've got to be careful that those who are coming here to study are doing this for the right reason. If they want to stay in the United States and work for companies in this country, I think we ought to encourage that. But we have to always take care that we are not compromising the integrity or the identity of basic information for our own national security and technology.
And when you think about that, you were talking about, I imagine this is the Keep STEM Talent Act that you and three other Democratic senators have introduced, the idea being that we can keep these international students who come here, particularly in the fields of STEM, and after they get their degrees. How hard is that now, especially as we think about our visa and immigration policy of the past couple of years?
Well, it's too hard and it doesn't make sense. In the Comprehensive Immigration Bill, which I wrote with a handful of senators, Democrats, and Republicans, and it passed the Senate 6 years ago, we said as follows. If you get an advanced degree in a STEM subject and you have a job offer in the United States, we hand you a green card. We want you to stay here. We want you to create jobs in this country rather than compete with American companies and send jobs overseas. I think that only makes sense. When I spoke to a commencement at the Illinois Institute of Technology a few years back, I said to him, it doesn't make sense for us to hand you a diploma and a map showing the way to get back out to O'Hare and catch a plane. It's better that the education and the talents you've developed create jobs and opportunity in the United States. And going back to the security concern, I want to make sure that's put on the table. But beyond that security concern, I think that foreign students who come here and obtain these educations should be given a chance to live in the United States.
I just want to ask you one more question about China since we've been talking about it, and there's so much news out of Hong Kong over the past couple of days. Organizers are saying there's at least 1 million people that have come to protest against a plan that would allow people in Hong Kong to be extradited to the mainland China. We've seen police using rubber bullets and tear gas during the most recent protests. Given the ongoing trade conversations we're having with China, should the U.S. government be raising this issue alongside of that?
Well, you would think any area of human rights should be part of our agenda, but under the Trump administration, that has not been the case. This president cozies up to some of the most authoritarian and even dictatorial leaders around the world, with a few exceptions, I might add. But it's just their style. It's just their approach. The current situation with China when it comes to these trade negotiations could get a lot worse before it gets better. And the president threatened as much yesterday. This could not only raise the cost of goods in the United States, it could jeopardize American jobs. and even worse, our farmers will tell you this, jeopardize our future reputation as a reliable trading partner. I don't want to go easy on China, but I don't want to hurt innocent people. And currently, we see a lot of our farmers and a lot of workers across America paying the price for this president's approach.
And I know that when we're thinking about this growing season and we're thinking about farmers, the growing season isn't going well. There's the trade conversations and concerns that you've just been discussing. But then there's also the weather when we're thinking about farmers haven't been able to plant their crops. I just want to start by asking you, I was watching your speech on the Senate floor. I think it was yesterday where you had that huge picture of a grain elevator in Alton. I know you were out this past weekend visiting a few places near the Mississippi and Illinois rivers. We're thinking about these floods and these. It's not really unprecedented anymore when we think about how often this flooding is happening, particularly near the Mississippi and Illinois rivers. Do you feel like the federal government is prepared for kind of this new normal of how many floods are happening and how this is affecting not just our agriculture, but a lot of towns?
Not even close. And let's put the cards on the table. Extreme weather is becoming the new normal. And we have to ask ourselves some basic questions. If there is some connection between human activity on this earth and changes in climate, what are we doing about it? Well, what this president decided to do was to make the United States the only country on earth that stepped away from the Paris Climate Agreement. Every other country in the world, every one of them, has sat down and said, we're willing to assume certain goals to try to make sure that we can leave a habitable earth for the next generation and beyond, except for President Trump. He walked away from it. Now, luckily, many state governments, our own included, under Governor Pritzker, are still going to move forward with common goals. We're seeing the private sector still aiming for these same goals of making sure that we reduce global warming. But it doesn't help to have the President of the United States fighting these efforts and trying to undermine them. This is something that we're going to pay a price for years to come. I don't know that we can reverse it. I wish we could. But at least we shouldn't make it worse for our kids and grandkids.
And what about right now for farmers for this season? What is the federal government's responsibility around this season?
Terrible situation. Yesterday, I had the Illinois Farm Bureau in. There are certain target dates and deadlines in our state for the planting of corn and soybeans, for example. If you go beyond that and plant later, you run the risk that your crop will be destroyed by frost. And that's what these farmers are up against. The fields are too wet because of heavy rains. There's a deadline in place for many government programs that the president created to help farmers who were hurt by his China trade policy. And the deadlines are coming and going. These farmers are genuinely concerned, and I'm trying to work with them to get some flexibility from the Department of Agriculture.
One last question for you, Senator Durbin. We mentioned President Trump quite a bit during these past few minutes, and when we're thinking about the 2020 election, there certainly seems to be no shortage of people who are putting up their hand to run for president. And I wonder, as some of these candidates have actually opted to run for president instead of running for the Senate, and as someone who's been in the Senate for quite some time, what's your pitch to potential candidates on why they should want to become a senator? Are you trying to recruit more folks to run for the Senate?
Oh, you bet I am. And I think some of the candidates running for president now, if they don't make it, may turn out to be senatorial candidates. I hope they'll consider that possibility. But let's be very honest about it. Under the McConnell leadership in the United States Senate, this institution is not what it's been historically and constitutionally. It really has diminished in terms of its role, and that's Senator McConnell's goal. He really is trying his best just to fill the courts with lifetime appointments of judges who lean to his political point of view, and we do virtually nothing else. Last week, the biggest news of the week in terms of substantive legislation was a unanimous consent, which meant no roll call, to approve striking a coin to commemorate women's suffrage. That's it. And nominations. And you wonder why people don't want to serve in the Senate. We've got to get back to the point where the Senate is a viable partner in the leadership of this country and start solving the problems facing American families, from the high cost of prescription drugs to preparing for retirement to having a tax code that gives working families a fighting chance. What we're saying to nominees or those who want to be nominees, join us in changing the Senate for the better. Let's put it back on the books as a viable constitutional entity.
That's Senator Dick Durbin, longtime representative of Illinois. Senator, thanks for taking the time to speak with me this morning. I appreciate it.
Good to be with you.
Here in Illinois, the state legislature has wrapped up its spring session. Now, Governor J.B. Pritzker is officially starting to sign bills into law. This morning, he signed the Reproductive Health Act. This law will ensure, quote, the fundamental right of a pregnant woman to have an abortion. It also removes further restrictions on abortions that are still in our state's legal code, including limits on late-term abortions. Illinois Democrats have said this law will be a safeguard if the Supreme Court overturns Roe versus Wade. It also solidifies Illinois' status as the state with the fewest restrictions on abortion in the Midwest. Here's Governor Pritzker at the bill signing earlier this morning.
Illinois is demonstrating what it means to affirm the rights of individuals to make the most personal and fundamental decisions of their lives, no matter their income level, no matter their race, ethnicity, or religion. When it comes to contraception, abortion, and reproductive care, this law puts the decision-making where it belongs, in the hands of women and their doctors. Yeah. Our laws will now reflect the rulings of the courts and the current practices in our state. And the Reproductive Health Act ensures that women's rights in Illinois do not hinge on the fate of Roe v. Wade or the whims of an increasingly conservative Supreme Court in Washington.
Stay tuned to this NPR station for this and more on other bills that the governor plans to sign into law. Coming up after the break, how our cities and towns can become better places to live for older people. We'll speak with members of a group called Age Friendly Champaign-Urbana and the AARP of Illinois. What do you think? How do you want your local community to better serve older residents? You can give us a call. Our phone number is 1-800-222-9455. That's 1-800-222-9455. I'm Nyla Boodoo. Stay tuned. You're listening to The 21st. Welcome back to The 21st. Thanks for tuning in. I'm Nyla Boodoo. Our country's demographics are always changing, and one big change that's coming, there will be more and more older adults in the U.S. In fact, our Census Bureau projects that people age 65 and older will be the largest age group in the country by 2035. So with that in mind, how well are our communities actually designed for older people? Several cities and towns across Illinois have decided it's important to commit publicly to making their communities, quote, age-friendly. Wendy Bartlow is an outreach specialist with the U of I's College of Applied Health Sciences. Kathleen Holden is a retired associate chancellor with the U of I, and they're both part of a group called Age Friendly CU that aims to make Champaign-Urbana a better place to live for older adults. They're with me in our Urbana studios. Wendy, Kathleen, good morning. Thanks for being here with me.
Thank you for having us.
Thank you.
From our partner station at NPR Illinois in Springfield, Ryan Grunenfelder is joining us. He's the director of advocacy and outreach with AARP Illinois. Hi, Ryan.
Hi.
And we'd also love to hear from all of you who are listening. If there are ways you think your community can better serve older residents, you can give us a call. Our phone number is 1-800-222-9455. That's 1-800-222-9455. Wendy, can I start by asking you to explain what Age Friendly CU actually does and who you work with?
Absolutely. So the Age Friendly Network of Communities, this is a World Health Organization program that's serviced by the AARP in the United States. We are just one of thousands of communities worldwide who have made a public commitment to make our cities more livable for residents of all ages, with a focus on older adults. But the idea is really that what's good for older adults is good for people of all ages. We all want safe, healthy communities. And by making something more accessible for older adults, you're not making it any less accessible for anyone else.
Kathleen, I noticed Wendy used the term older adults. I think oftentimes, particularly those of us in the media, use the term senior citizen. Is that, I imagine it's a conscious choice on your part to not use that term.
Yeah. One of the things that we've been learning about with Age Friendly is there is a real ageism. There are a lot of words to describe frail elderly people. There's not that many positive words to describe growing older. And so one of the things we're trying to do is moving away from the frail elderly mindset to the active, vibrant, older adult mindset. So, yeah, it's a deliberate choice.
Mm-hmm. And you retired from the U of I in 2005. How did you become interested in advocating for these solutions to make your community in Champaign-Urbana better for older adults?
Well, in 2006. 2006.
Retired, oh, thank you for correcting me.
The chancellor asked if I would come back and set up the Osher Lifelong Learning Institute on a part-time basis. And so that got me started thinking about how older adults can continue to make contributions and continue to grow. It can be a really exciting phase of life. It's not just marching towards death. And so setting up that program and seeing how, you know, the 1,000 members that we had, I think there's 1,300 now, got excited about learning and participating with one another in learning experiences. It really energized me. And then when I was asked to serve on the board of Clark Lindsay Village, it's a very progressive retirement community. And so I had a chance to see how things could be made so much better for people. And those are the success stories. But there's also areas where we really need to help older adults connect with one another, to have safe and affordable housing, to have adequate health care. All of those things are going to be addressed by Age Friendly. So that's how I got excited about more than you wanted to know, I'm sure.
No, that's very helpful. That's Kathleen Holden. Wendy Bartlow is in studio with as well with us here in Urbana. And Ryan Grudenfelder is on the line from Springfield with AARP Illinois. So, Ryan, Champaign and Urbana are two of seven cities in Illinois that have made this commitment to being age-friendly. The other ones are Alton, Arlington Heights, Danville, Evanston, Woodstock. What does it mean from a municipal standpoint to make this commitment?
Well, what it means for them is they will have access to resources from AARP and the World Health Organization to connect with innovative solutions with regards to what we call AARP's domains, eight domains of livability in communities, domains such as affordable housing, social participation, communication and information, health services, access to parks and recreation and things like that. All of those and so much more make up what age friendliness and a livable community is for people. And the focus of it is not just for people, and AARP uses the phrase 50 plus adults. It's not just for those 50 plus, but it's for people of all ages. So someone who is 11 years old can get around a community just as well as someone who is over 60.
Mm. In general, how well do you think our towns and cities are set up to support older residents, Ryan?
Well, there are a lot of opportunities for growth in many Illinois communities, and it's wonderful that Champaign-Urbana, who was one of the first communities in the state of Illinois, joined the Age Friendly Network, and there are several others that are working on the process. But the opportunity is for communities to think not just about what they currently have, but also what other innovations exist to make residents love their community even more, because that's really what's most important within this age friendliness and this livable is people to be able to be supported in their community enough to love where they live even more. So things like access to broadband internet is a big issue, or access to telehealth services, or having, say, audible crosswalks, or so someone who is deaf may not know that a light has changed, but they could if they could hear it, and sorry, not deaf, but someone who can't see. Or even things like having fitness parks within park districts that are outdoors and have access to healthy living. Things like that all are things that people that live in communities can come together, say in Champaign or Evanston or Alton or wherever they may be, in order to have a true sense of what they want for their community.
That's Ryan Grunenfelder with AARP Illinois. Wendy Bartlow is also with us. And Wendy, some of the things that Ryan was mentioning, that Kathleen was mentioning, a lot of it comes down to different infrastructure development. And I want to ask you about transportation, because I think that can be a very big part of this. What is our transportation system? And let's use Champaign-Urbana as example. How much is Champaign-Urbana's transportation system set up to support older residents right now? And what are some of the challenges or the hurdles involved with that?
So there are some challenges and hurdles, and that's one of the things that we're addressing specifically in the plan. A lot of it, there are barriers to using the transportation system, and a lot of it can be sometimes lack of information. One of the things that we're actually working to develop is a bus buddy program. This would be a program where younger people go out and ride the bus with older people and kind of help them see, figure out how to ride the bus, maybe how to get a dash pass. If they have some kind of mobility issue, how to get on and off the bus safely. I think sometimes there can be a fear that people think that, well, you know, I'm going to look foolish if I don't know how this works. So it would be an opportunity for older people and younger people to connect around this. Also things like learning the routes, figuring out a place to sit while they're waiting for the bus, things like that. We're also exploring, are there barriers to older people using rideshare services like Uber and Lyft as well?
Mm-hmm. And in fact, we've been, so if you're listening to this conversation and you want to join in and chime in with either questions or comments about how your community can be more, as we're talking about being a better age-friendly community, our phone number is 1-800-222-9455. That's 1-800-222-9455. And we've been talking about this on social media. We started the conversation on our Facebook page about this yesterday. And Kara from Urbana wrote, "One of the reasons I hear people drive past when they might be physically able is that transportation services available to them, especially in more rural areas, require 24 to 48 hours notice. They don't know if they'll feel, quote, up to going to a particular activity that far in advance. Also, they want transportation to more things than doctor's appointments. Social activities are important for well-being, too." Kathleen, I wonder how much this comment resonates with what you've seen or what you've thought about when we're thinking about transportation.
Yeah, one of the things I really like about Kara's comment, and I'll say this before I mention transportation, it's really important that older adults be part of the process, part of the leadership process. Not that we're doing it for older adults, but we're doing it with older adults. So someone like Kara, I would want to ask her, so what kinds of things would help you? Would it be a point-to-point system? Because right now we don't have that. We have a stop-to-stop system. And if it was a point-to-point system, how would that work? Let's look at communities that may perhaps have those kinds of systems. I think that one of the exciting things is to look at models of other places, because I don't think we have to reinvent the wheel. I think some of the models are out there. But I think it's really important for us to listen to older adults and to involve them in solving the problems.
Ryan, I wonder how you think this looks and if this is harder in a rural area versus an urban area. I imagine you at AARP Illinois are trying to figure out how you can tackle this for cities and towns of all sizes and then for rural areas as well.
Yeah, it absolutely is harder in rural areas for people to get access to the transportation that they need. You mentioned, you know, ride-sharing services. They have become far more prominent in communities across the state and across the nation. They're certainly an option, but then there are other things that, as we're thinking about age friendliness, that we need to consider, such as someone who does not have the ability to get from their front door down to the street in order to get into a car. Are those ride sharing services accessible? Does a person of an older age even understand how to use the app in order to make that type of thing happen? And so there are a number of things that need to be considered as we look at that particular option, as well as, you know, any of these other issues that affect older adults who are trying to live in a livable community.
And when we're thinking about other issues, I wanted to ask about, to Kara's point as well, about social activities, improving the social life of older adults. And I wonder, Wendy, how much you guys are thinking about isolation or loneliness.
We're thinking about that a lot, because that's probably the biggest threat to the health of older adults. And I mean, I think there's a statistic that says that being socially isolated is comparable to smoking like 15 cigarettes a day or something like that. It's very stressful on the cardiac system. And but so this is a big part of age-friendly Champaign-Urbana. The two best things that an older person can do to keep themselves healthy every day are having actual conversations with people and leaving the house. So we want to make sure that we're facilitating that, having places to go, but also being able to get there. So it does link back to transportation. But one of the things that we are developing is it's going to be called Champaign Seniors. It's being led by Champaign Moms. We're acting as an advisor to them. It's really going to be for older adults and their families. It's going to be, some of it's going to be, it'll be a website. Some of it will be information about services, but a lot of it will be social things for older people to go and do. But the focus will also be giving older adults the information that they're curious about the event, not just here's an event that's happening you might enjoy, but also this is how far away you'll have to park. This is the bathroom situation at this event. So if someone knows that, you know, they're going to be able to find a parking space, that they're not going to be have to park 6 blocks away, or that here is a bus stop right by the event where you can get off, they're not going to have to walk a long distance, that if it's outside, there will be accessible bathrooms. Those types of things will also be focused on.
Kathleen, I wonder also, as Wendy's talking about this, how important intergenerational social activity is and how important that is to you?
It's very important, both for the older adult and for the child, and for the youth. I was in on a panel with some young folks, and they were feeling that sometimes older adults don't understand them. It was kind of an eye-opener. This young man said, sometimes older adults don't give me enough credit for being able to do things because I don't have the experience that they do. And I think we need to talk to one another. We need to interact with one another. We have a program that I think Ethel and Maude does a program for young people to help older adults with technology. And they both have a good time. The young folks are having a good time showing the older adult how to make things work, and the older adult gets excited because they can make it work. Those kinds of interactions are really important. I think the idea of the Sun City thing where you have these huge communities where there's only old people, older adults, they're not as happy as if they can interact with children. And so I think that's part of the mental health. We need to celebrate the all ages, not just older adults or younger people.
Ryan, is that also where you think ageism comes from, when people don't have that interaction?
Absolutely, yeah. There's a lot of stereotypes that various generations might have about one generation or the other. But if they actually sit down and talk, they will find that they have a lot more in common than they realize. And I've seen examples where there's been programs where someone who's experienced in a skill or a trade or a hobby such as music, where somebody that's older could teach them what they know about it, and, you know, in reverse, somebody that's younger could teach them about the way things are now and how things are developing within their generation. I've seen it happen on multiple levels, and it's really been inspiring to see generations come together that can do that, and that's those type of social possibilities are there for every community out there if people get together and make them happen.
We're almost out of time, but Kathleen, I just want to ask you one last question just about connecting all the dots here. As we're talking about, by 2035, Americans age 65 and older are projected to be the largest age group in the country. We've been talking about some of the ways you folks here in Champaign-Urbana are working on trying to make life better for older residents. How do you want this knowledge to affect the way we think about our communities?
Oh, that's a good question. I would like that knowledge to, I would like people to be able to say, I am so proud to live in this community where people care about one another, they listen to one another, they try to make things better for one another. That's what I would like.
That's Kathleen Holden, co-chair of the Age-Friendly CU Steering Committee. We've been also learning about that with Wendy Bartlow, who is also with Age-Friendly CU and teaches at U of I and the College of Applied Health Sciences. I want to thank Ryan Grunenfelder for being with us from Springfield, where he's the director of advocacy and research at AARP Illinois. All of you, thanks for being with me. I appreciate it.
Thank you.
Thank you, Noah.
Thank you.
Thanks for tuning in to The 21st. I'm Nyla Boodoo. Are you headed out for vacation this summer? Maybe you've already started your travels and you're listening to us via podcast or an app. If you're concerned about big crowds, there's good reason. Last year, Millennium Park in Chicago became the Midwest's top visited destination with a tally of 13 million visitors. Take a place like the Louvre in Paris. While not free, it had around 10 million visitors last year. Perhaps so many that the museum, quote, suffocates, according to the workers' union in a statement. They walked out just last month over the management's handling of overcrowded conditions there, and they're not alone. If you're thinking about overcrowding, overusing, overstaying, in other words, over-tourism, the kind that's not only harming special destinations, but the environment and life for locals. Hannah Sampson's been reporting on this for the Washington Post's new, by the way, travel destination product. They're about to debut in a couple of, I think next week. She's on the line with us now from Washington. Hi, Hannah. Welcome to the 21st.
Hi, thanks for having me.
Robert Chanik is also with us from Chicago. He's a business reporter for the Tribune, and he recently wrote about Illinois' investment in tourism and our own infrastructure woes. Hi, Robert. Thanks for being here with us as well.
Good to be with you.
So, Hannah, I think a lot of our listeners are traveling in and out of Illinois, including out of the country this summer. So we can talk about Illinois specifically in a minute. But I wonder, when we think about over-tourism, how much of this happens in, for example, Europe?
A lot of it happens in Europe. I think that's really the area that gets the most attention because there are so many iconic destinations that are seeing such huge volumes of people that they're really in the news. You've got like Venice, Amsterdam, Barcelona, Prague. All of these are just rising in popularity as more people around the world are traveling. And the protests from locals, the problems in the local communities are really increasing along with those rising number of tourists.
And when we say problems, Hannah, what kind of things are we talking about?
Well, so you have some extremes, like in the last couple of weeks, there was an out-of-control cruise ship in Venice that kind of barreled into a canal and forced people to flee screaming. But then you have, so that was like the disaster movie scenario. But then you have the more kind of everyday problems, like in Amsterdam, where residents complain that people are throwing up in the street and they can't get around and people are being disrespectful of their community. So it really ranges from just the everyday quality of life to like real physical damage. So you really have kind of a spectrum of issues that people who live in those places are facing.
And so another consideration, Hannah, too, is when a place becomes maybe suddenly trendy and isn't equipped to handle a sudden influx of tourists. And I wonder, it's not like a Venice or a Paris. And when we're thinking particularly about TV shows, that actually ends up being a big driver of tourism these days, right?
Yeah, I mean, HBO can double as a travel agency or a travel company because Game of Thrones, everybody in the world watches Game of Thrones, and now everybody wants to go to Croatia, specifically Dubrovnik, which, you know, I'm sure had visitors before, but it's really gotten out of hand to the point where they've had to limit the number of cruise ships that can call at any one time because the city center has just been so inundated. So Dubrovnik, also Northern Ireland, has seen that from Game of Thrones. And now we actually had a story just, I think, yesterday that, of all places,
This is Chernobyl. I was looking at the Instagram pictures of people Instagramming themselves at Chernobyl, in some cases super inappropriate pictures, Hannah.
There will always be an influencer or two who just takes it too far. You know, tourists and regular visitors, they're going to want to document what they're doing. And in most cases, you can do that pretty respectfully. But there's also a line. And I've seen some of those same pictures that you're talking about. Some people are definitely.
Yeah, scantily clad pictures in front of a Chernobyl site seems a little odd and weird. Yes.
Yeah, poor taste.
We're talking about over tourism. That's Hannah Sampson with the Washington Post. By the way, Robert Chanik is with us as well. He's a business reporter for the Chicago Tribune. So, okay, Robert, I don't know that people are flocking to Illinois in the way they are to Croatia, like a Game of Thrones vacation, although I think sometimes being on Illinois roads can be like scaling the wall. You wrote about some of these challenges for the Tribune. We will tweet that out. What is the state spending on, first of all, on promoting tourism within Illinois?
This year they're spending $15 million, so they're almost doubling the ad campaign. This is the advertising budget specifically. Last year it was $8 million, so they're beefing up their ad campaign, and the pitch is essentially to take an extended road trip across the state. I mean, that's kind of where they're coming from, which we thought was at least somewhat ironic given the fact that the roads in Illinois are kind of in terrible shape. And as you probably know, we just approved a big capital budget of which includes, I think, $33 billion to repair transportation infrastructure over the next 6 years. So that won't happen in time for the summer's road trip. But I guess people may want to take their chances and hit the road anyway.
Well, Robert, when we think about that, I think it's either potholes, which can be pretty bad. And I will say, especially on 57 these days, the potholes are terrible. But or there's construction happening, which is kind of also, I feel like, the sign of summer season in Illinois if there's construction. When we're thinking about the idea of the state encouraging people and taking a road trip, where are some of the places they're encouraging people to go in Illinois?
Pretty far flung, and by the way, I was looking at some numbers just to kind of get up to speed. But state had, I think it was 114 million visitors last year across the state. Half of those are in Chicago, so
that makes
sense.
Know,
if you're talking about overcrowding, you know, and you mentioned Millennium Park, obviously some of the more distant locations might be a little more wide open, but they have a number of commercials queued up to go for this summer. And they pitched Galena, which is a longstanding sort of traditional northwestern Illinois destination. A lot of southern Illinois, which, you know, Shawnee National Forest, Matheson State Park, et cetera. And that, interestingly, I was just doing the math there. It's a 6-hour drive 350 miles south of Chicago to get to southern Illinois if you want to do the nature thing there. So that requires quite a bit of road work to get there. And they also were pitching, it was kind of fun, you know, sites around along the old Route 66 starting in Will County and working your way down. And so, you know, that's the theme. They want people to stay overnight as well. Meaning, you know, a
right,
lot
pay
of
for
trips.
Hotels, sure. Robert, yeah, what about apart from roads? I mean, I think rail is a possibility in some parts of Illinois. You mentioned the capital infrastructure plan. Is there anything for rail in that, or is that always federal dollars?
Oh, yeah. No, and they have some pretty big projects in the bill. I just going over it, but one is I think it's $275 million for the Amtrak passenger rail between Chicago and Rockford. Similar budget, like $225 million for the passenger rail to the Quad Cities. And also I saw $100 million for improvements in the line between Chicago and Carbondale, which is, you know, another way to get downstate to the
Yeah, that's a pretty big rail line,
south.
Too.
Yeah.
Hannah, when we're thinking about infrastructure, how big of an issue is it when the infrastructure of a popular destination can't support the tourism that happens there?
It can be so big that the destination just has to just give up and shut down, either very temporarily or for a long time. These are extreme cases, but there's a beach in Thailand that has shut down for I think it'll be maybe 3 years when it finally reopens, just because so many people were coming and damaging it, and it needed a chance to recover. Justin Bieber did a music video in a canyon in Iceland, and they had to shut that down because the Justin Bieber fans were flocking to that. And on a smaller scale, I don't know if you remember earlier this year, the poppy apocalypse in California, where there was just a gorgeous wildflower
yes,
bloom.
Yeah, because everyone was talking about the pictures they were taking.
Exactly. And they had to shut down the streets for a day because they just it was just gridlock and they couldn't do anything. So that's the worst case scenario. You know, in smaller scenarios, there's much traffic management that needs to be done. There's money that needs to be spent on, you know, extra police, extra guards along walkways so that people don't get hit by traffic. Yeah, it can be very detrimental if not managed properly.
So, Hannah, we've been talking about some of the nightmare scenarios here. Are there places that have been able to overcome or deal with this and deal with the over-tourism? Who's doing a good job of managing this?
I don't know that we have, like, great examples, but there are efforts going on. For example, Machu Picchu, which is often cited as one non-Europe destination that's grappling with too many people, is selling timed entrances and limiting the amount of time that people can spend hiking. That's one way to do it, just kind of spread out the visitors and make them plan in advance so you're not being inundated all at once. And some national parks actually have been considering this also in the U.S. because they've been so popular that that's the only thing they can do to manage the traffic.
Yeah, state parks too. I mean, with Starved Rock here in Illinois has talked about whether they would have to move to something like that because they've had so many days they've actually had to shut the park down because they have so many people in it.
Exactly. And you know, churches in Europe are doing the same thing. So the days I think of just kind of walking up to some iconic place and waltzing in, that may be over.
And when you think about that, Hannah, I wonder if we can just end by just tips for people who are listening. So for our listeners who are thinking about summer travel, whether they plan their destinations or not, how can we be smarter about the way we go to these destinations?
Yeah, so this is actually a story that I'm working on now, but kind of the broad suggestions are do some research on where you're going. If it's a super congested place, and there are some tools out there that can tell you, especially in Europe, when a destination is going to be really crowded, either avoid them or think of going in the times when they will not be so congested.
Like
so
not this summer, in other words.
Not this summer. Maybe kick your trip over to fall. Or think about visiting a neighboring area or some neighborhoods within a popular destination that get less ink that get less pictures on Instagram, maybe. Make your reservations in advance, like we were saying. Try to avoid traveling with massive groups, because if you show up at a restaurant with 20 other people, it's not going to be good for anybody. Consider hiring a local guide. Some experts say that, because they'll know where to go, they'll know what's crowded, they'll know the local spots, and they can kind of be your link to the locals so that you're not barging in not knowing anything.
One last quick question for you. Hannah, I know, by the way, is debuting soon. That's a good place for people to go for information. But you've been a travel reporter for a long time. What advice do you have for people to find sort of hidden gems or places where people haven't gone before?
You know, I would talk to your networks. Ask your friends where they've gone that wasn't super crowded. That's always a good way. And look at those lists of like top 10 places to go, and then don't go to them.
don't go to the top 10. Oh, that's a good way.
try to be a little more creative in your research. Maybe, you know, just look for the places that are some of the least visited and try to do your planning there.
That's Hannah Sampson. She's a reporter with the new product from the Washington Post. It's called By the Way. You can check that out soon. Robert Chanik has been with us as well, a reporter for the Chicago Tribune, telling us a little bit more about infrastructure. We'll tweet out both of their stories. Hannah, Robert, thanks for being with me. I appreciate it.
Thank you so
much.
My
pleasure.
That's all the time we have for today. But before we go, we wanted to say farewell to our producer, Robin Lynn. She's been with us for nearly 2 years. During that time, Robin has produced some of our favorite conversations, whether it was an interview on evangelical Christians and climate change, women in personal finance, or where to get the best food in the Midwest. If you're a regular listener to the 21st and you heard our holiday conversation with our producers, you know that on top of all of that, Robin's real passion is for murder mysteries. Here she is trying to sell me on them.
The murder happens right out of the gate, so you're not filled with suspense about when that's going to happen. You don't see the gory details of them. You are just waiting for the comforting resolve, knowing that the characters that you really love and invested your time in are going to come to the solution and that all will be well.
That's a little bit of the conversations that we have when we're not on air. We thanks again to Robin for all of her great work with us. We wish her the very best. If you're a podcast fan, you can find her work on the show Obscure with the comedian Michael Ian Black. We're also produced by Libby Foster, Anna Casey, and Alan Montesilio, who's our senior producer. Eunice Alpasan and Jasper Davidoff are our interns. Technical direction and engineering comes from Jason Croft and Steve Morg. Special thanks to the band Public Access for our theme music. The 21st is a production of Illinois Public Media. I'm Nyla Boodoo. Thanks for listening. We'll see you back here tomorrow.